Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today we talk with Danny Anderson of the Sectarian Review and part one of a two-part episode.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today I'm talking with Danny Anderson of Sectarian Review and the Christian Humanist Network. He's also a professor of literature at
Mount Aloysius College.
Thank you. I knew it was Mount something or other. In Pennsylvania?
Crescent, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. What part of, is that in Pennsylvania?
It is. That's right. What people told me when I first moved here, actually. And it really kind of makes me mad, frankly. I don't know. I have to say, this is maybe not the way you wanted to begin, but I hate approaching the place you're serving with contempt, right? And people who are like, oh, our students are such idiots. It's Pennsylvania. That drives me nuts because they're not, okay? And yeah, but we are in that area. It's right between Johnstown and Altoona. So, that helps you. Yeah.
My ex is from Johnstown, and I have briefly lived in that area. So yeah. That's why I called it Pennsylvania. It's more just because, like, you know, it is. To me, that's more of a regional designation. I don't have an anti-Appalachian bias. And I didn't find people there to be particularly dumb. I found people everywhere to be mediocre because that's literally what it means.
That's what mediocre means. No, you're right. Is there a sociological term for the place I live? It's both rural and industrial. It's like a weird kind of like rural rust belt. I don't even know if there's like a demographic designation to describe where
there
we live.
There are parts of the South that are ex-urban that are similar, that are formerly industrial, but have been rural, been semi-ruralized. Are they firmly industrial and they've been suburbanized, but it's suburban in the, like, all the cool people have moved to bigger cities and now live in there. And, like, it's now, like, the suburbs are kind of a little bit of a wasteland and they're falling apart. Like, it's that.
Yeah.
And that's a Sun Belt, Rust Belt phenomenon. You don't see it here in the Mountain West. You don't see it in the liberal outpost where there's lots and lots of money. You know, I sometimes like to call it Hillbilly Elegy Country, even though I both love and hate that book.
Yeah. That's actually a good, because it's the industry that was here is not like steel. Well, Johnstown had steel, of course, but it's mostly small towns around former coal mines, right?
Right.
And so now it's like prisons and things like that instead of coal mines. But yeah, so it's got this weird kind of like rusty, empty warehouse look, but it isn't like Cleveland where I'm from, kind of.
Right. So I like to, like, I'm from Central Georgia, which is not part of Appalachia. It's, you know, but like from that point up, you have these spots, right? Like if you're not in a major developing urban area like Atlanta or like the big urban areas in the Carolinas, particularly North Carolina, or around DC, you're kind of in this like strip of greater Appalachia that used to be extractive and now is like prisons and Walmarts, and the Walmarts are gone.
Yeah.
And
yeah. For everyone who hates Walmart, what happened? Watch those towns when Walmart leaves and see how bad it gets. Right. And so, yeah, that happens in West Virginia where my family's from a lot.
Yeah. I'm a red state red.
Not that I'm pro Walmart. Incidentally, I think I should say that on this show.
No, but they're like, it sits in a cycle that when you, like, that, like, you don't go back to the past, you go back to a place that's worse.
Yeah.
Like, the damage has already been done, my friends, and, yeah. Yeah, I like to joke that I'm a red state red, so that means that I am much more sympathetic to rural-urban divides, and I think the prominent divide in American culture is rural-urban, but the other major divide is rich. It's coastal, but coastal actually here is not translates to rich. Fair, I mean, like, the area is rich. It's not that there's tons of poor people in, like, the Bay Area. There are. But if you're not on the absolute bottom and can't get out of the Bay Area, you're over $120,000 a year. You're like, getting on the edge of, like, beyond upper middle class. Like, don't fool yourself. And that's kind of... that's true across the board. A lot of the cities have gone that, DC's gone that way. I mean, DC's now more expensive than most of New York. I mean, it's except for like Manhattan. And where I live in, even in the Mountain West, the cities are beginning to turn into that. And because people are running from like California and Seattle to like Denver and Salt Lake and Boise. But it's increasing the property value so fast, we're beginning to have the same problem. Because, you know, you bought a house on debt in California, you have enough equity to have, like, $2,000 selling it and only after 20% increase. And then, like, you can buy a house here outright for that, or you could a year ago. And
yeah. Yeah, if you worked, I imagine, just some sort of normal office job in San Francisco, if you moved to Johnstown,
you could buy a block.
It would be like moving to Honduras or something like that. I mean, you could like retire for the rest of your life at 50, probably, you know? Yeah, easily. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've actually thought about that. Although what I'm probably going to do myself when I decide to be truly the occulted old mom that I am, is I'm going to go to Southern Mexico and just hide out. Cause you know, make people come to me in, like, Oaxaca.
The guru. I could totally see you doing this, actually.
have to approach a semi-arm compound, you know.
Sorry, guys, can everybody hear my bells? Can you hear the bells in the background? I'm at work. And
yeah, it's fine. Chimes.
Sorry.
It gives us character. So I wanted to talk to you, Danny. I didn't just want to like talk about regional weirdnesses in class, although that is one of my favorite things to talk to people about. I wanted to talk to you about the current state of politics, Christianity, and secularization. Because I think most people have the secularization narrative wrong.
Okay. Most people from within or without Christianity?
Both, actually.
Okay. Okay.
So there's the narrative and without is kind of that I hear from a lot of people, not just people who would think of themselves as new atheists. It's like this, you know, valiant march towards scientific progress. And you know, like if you look at millennials, like I think something like religiosity is down to like 50% or something. Like it's much lower than the two generations above it. Like of my cohort, just in my normie day job of people under, like people over 40 are almost overwhelmingly religious here. They're LDS for the most part, are Catholic. People my age are the upper end of the millennial, lower end of the Gen X are like, you can flip a coin. And then actually secular people were the majority of the educated people I worked with. But what I've found personally is, one, no one knows what reason is, so don't tell me people are getting more reasonable. Two, all kinds of weird, like everything from anti-vax to, which I know a lot of the new atheist people fight, but like to just weird, like astrology, stuff like that. None of that's been dented. It's pretty common. And three, the religious people themselves, I think, are secularized.
Oh, yeah. That is, I totally agree.
And meaning like this, like even in, this happened kind of as early as the 80s. Like we talked years ago or a year or two ago about the crisis of the scandal of the evangelical mind, right? But like we have to remember how much power these groups had in the 70s and 80s after like the new left fell. Like a lot of people found God.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had never left it in the first place. And it took this weird apocalyptic tone at the end of the Cold War, and that was really reinforcing. And then it kind of emerged in the 90s as a political force. But actually, in a way, it was already a sign of its retreat in my mind, because you saw them, and when you really saw this, I remember in the Bush administration years, a lot of liberals had this view that it was secretly run by Dominionists.
Yeah, I now that you mention that, I can recall conversations. Yeah,
yeah, and like you know the J Street stuff and the K Street stuff. Yeah, and some of that stuff is real, but a lot of it was like, but George Bush honestly was a middle of the road. Like he was actually one of the few. Like he was a mainline Protestant. Even he wasn't. I mean, he was evangelical in the loosest sense.
Yeah,
you would think he was what, like a Presbyterian or something.
Oh God! That, I mean, they're up from Maine, right?
Or
I mean,
Methodist. So it was right, one of those like, yes, they're kind of evangelical churches and they're evangelical rings, but it's really not that.
I mean, that term is so mushy that it's almost useless. I mean, I think sometimes it's used as like a stand-in for kind of brain dead Christianity in general, right?
Right.
And it works in that way. I'll say that.
It replaced Fundy because it was because most evangelicals, even now, even if they're politicized, even if they like believe in like say creation science or something, they're not actually fundamentalists. So
In what sense?
Well, I mean, like in the, the history of fundamentalism, like we take the Bible as a set of scientific propositions, which itself actually is a secular act.
Right. No, sure. I get where you're going there. So, but to go back to the squishiness of evangelicalism as a term, one of its strengths, though, was as a kind of, with the kind of Ralph Reed, moral majority sort of coalitions. Mm-hmm. Those political coalitions, I think, were a big enough umbrella that it brought in so many denominations that really don't get along at all in any theological sense. The Calvinist Wesleyan fights are so annoying to me growing up in the Wesleyan end of it. But those denominations don't get along at all well at all, except in this kind of political sphere. And so in that way, I think of evangelicalism as more of a political term than any kind of theological one. In that sense, I think it makes some sense about what you're saying there. But the other thing, though, to go back a little bit about secularization. And so in the secular world, in the truly secular world, where you have people like Richard Dawkins and those, the new atheist types who see progress as necessarily the leaving behind of religious faith and dogma, right? And that's
lately he's been backtracking on that, but yes.
Yeah, but I mean, you get that progress is marked by our willingness to leave those things behind and depend more and more and ultimately exclusively on rationality, right? And that kind of thing. And so that hasn't actually worked. Even as people have left these kind of traditional, let's all just use Christian with a small c because it's all of its forms, structures and institutions, they have increasingly, you got people with like crystals and stuff like that. So like spiritualism and that kind of thing is actually kind of on the rise amongst millennials. And so I think that you've got a weird paradox there on that end of it. And on the Christian end of it, I think they thought, the church that I grew up in, the way that we all just sort of believed, I think I was sort of led to think of it in this way, just by the practices of everything, that secularization meant like worldliness and sort of an anti-holiness kind of a way of abandoning God's, the Ten Commandments and all that stuff. And I think what they didn't take track of all that time, the church itself, was the ways that in which it operated was secular, right? And you see this, and so that would, the secularization was more institutional and not necessarily the content of any beliefs, right? And so without being aware of that, I think Christianity has utterly shown itself to be an almost entirely secular endeavor, especially, and it's really showing itself in this last decade.
Well, my personal opinion on that is you don't have secularism without Christianity. The divide of the political sphere from the religious sphere, which is great for capitalism, but like that actually does kind of emerge in Christianity in the beginning, and definitely by the time you start getting to the wars of religion in the 13th, 14th century. Mm-hmm. So I actually do view this as a long durée thing coming out of the crisis in the Western Church, which itself, because I'm still a Marxist on these things, wasn't totally prompted by belief. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I literally can't imagine it any other way. But my other thing about this is, aside from some cranky atheists like John Gray or like old school Nietzscheans, not the new school, racist ones, but who have pointed out that like secular humanism and to some degree new atheism, its liberal paradigms and its value systems is a mixture of utilitarianism and Christianity. It's not really utilitarian, because if it was truly majoritarian, all these minority rights stuff would mean nothing, frankly. Mm-hmm. Like nobody's rights would matter because the and particularly if you take the Peter Singer view, of utilitarianism where, like, every living being counts, like, humans don't even get a vote. So then you have this fallback on to, like, natural law, which has been this thing, even going back to deism, but that's a Catholic and Islamic framework. But you know what it really does is you basically say your moral values are natural. And as a lot of Islamic scholars have pointed out, oh, these natural moral values, such and say France, they just look Christian. And they do, frankly. Mm-hmm. They look like a deracinated, watered down, kind of obnoxious, and in America, puritanical, loud, and annoying Christianity. And that's true even for the secular right, except the secular right's harder to deal with because they're not consistent on that in the way like the secular left or the secular liberals would be. They don't have a code of morality. And I mean that very literally. Like, you try to press them down, and unless they're libertarians, in which they have a single valence code, which is silly, but at least they have it. Like, you can't pin them down on anything. Like, try to argue with Richard Spencer about what his moral dictates are, and half the time they're liberal, but just for white people, and half the time you can't pin anything down at all, and you get this weird naturalistic fallacy, which has already started, like the entire secular ethical world was kind of a naturalistic fallacy for Christian ethics.
Yeah.
And also, like, I also find the particular flavor of New Atheism, which argues about science, to be itself weirdly Protestant, like a weird result of Protestant liberalism. So that's my take on the long durée of this, but I'm not in the immediate durée of this. I'm not a Christian. So,
right.
It's not that I don't partake in religious stuff, but like I was listening today, for example, that, this is racialized and probably also classized, but like white evangelicals, for example, are more supportive of the GOP than ever, but they're a smaller portion of the GOP coalition than ever. What do you make of that for the standpoint of Christian power? Because I think that actually, and like people think that indicates strength. I think that, like, and that we're heading towards something like Handmaid's Tale land. And I think it's actually this is a sign of something that's in some ways the opposite of that. Not that Handmaid's Tale land couldn't happen, but I actually, like, I don't think it's, you're looking at something like majoritarian conservative Christian power at all, even amongst white people.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, I can't imagine those ideas holding that kind of sway over even the Republican Party, let alone the society at large. Right. So, I mean, even on the issue of even on these sort of like the big issues that have always kind of motivated Christianity, like the evangelical coalition, are, you know, abortion and gay marriage. And those are sort of the big two of my lifetime. Right. And I mean, and they have like consistently lost in the public sphere on both of those. Right. Now there's some with abortion, you've got some like sort of state legislature power being shown. And that certainly does, those folks are coming out of that, those kind of evangelical religious beliefs. Right. But it's still really marginal in the broader sphere of things, I think. And so,
and even in those areas, so like to like break down Georgia, for example, yeah. Abrams almost won Georgia.
Yeah.
So it's almost like these are like paroxysms of like trying to assert power because you know you're not going to have it for a whole lot longer. So like you're backed against the wall, and that's more dangerous, actually.
Yeah. And you're like taking advantage of bizarre sort of state legislative districts. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the way that, you know, with redistricting, I know where I'm from, Ohio, and in Pennsylvania, too, is a big issue. I mean, a minority party holds majority power on the representative scale because of just the way they've drawn districts, right? And so, yeah, Abrams almost wins the governorship in a general vote, but legislatively at the state level in Georgia, it's overwhelmingly Republican, right? Just because of the way the districts are drawn. And so that's the only, I mean, it appears that there's power being wielded there, but it's just kind of this false facade of power, I think, that's enabled by those kinds of that electioneering basically down there. But yeah, and I would say if you look at, there was recently a poll this week about the treatment, whether the U.S. should welcome migrants, just on that, the basic question, I think it was how it was, that was the level of which it was written. So this isn't even really about the border crisis right now, right? This is just in general, should we be welcoming to immigrants or refugees, maybe it was. Mm-hmm. And Catholics were disproportionately in favor of it. Other, you know, Orthodox traditions were as well. You get to evangelicals and it's only like 20% or 25% of people who were in favor of welcoming immigrants, which is like kind of a core Christian value, like as it's, as the text is written in the Bible. Right. And so there's like, that's a demonstration to me that that partnership, that political partnership did more to change the Christian coalition into the political image of the party than vice versa. And so I think that what you're seeing as the Republican Party shrinks, I think it's going to be sort of in lockstep with the shrinkage of influence in these evangelical churches, which are kind of just withering.
Right. Well, I mean, where is there evangelical growth in the world? It's actually in Latin America and the Catholic world where it's countercultural, although it is conservative there too. But
oh, conservative in what ways, though?
Well, it has imported a lot of American neoliberal assumptions, frankly.
Okay, and so not just on like sexual ethics or anything like that. Like
no, it's conservative in economics. It's actually probably less conservative in some things on sexual ethics. Like it's like not against birth control, for example. But so I think what you're seeing is a real alignment. I mean, the elephant in the room is 10 years ago, Protestants were no longer counting them as a unified bloc was always funny to me. Do you include Mormons, for example? But, right. You know, it's funny because I, you know, I live in Utah and no one even thinks about the debates about that. The Christian school, and I interviewed for a Christian school once, and which was interesting. it didn't require a statement of faith, and then I realized they were LDS. And then I was like, oh, that's funny because most of the rest of the country, you're not considered a Christian. Yeah. but even that hostility is sort of ending because, I mean, like, in a real way, because in some ways, like, although the LDS is liberalizing too, actually, but in some ways, like, evangelicals totally kick out the LDS, they lose their Western States coalition in the Sun Belt, like.
I mean, would that matter, though? I mean, do they need to have formal relations to vote the same way? Like, I can't imagine Mormons voting Democrat now. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, that's a question I have.
They do. They do in Salt Lake. Salt Lake is an overwhelmingly Democratic city.
Right. But by and large, as
well. No,
I'm saying.
I can't either. Well, yeah, but I don't know how long. I don't know that that's going to. Here's this is from living in Mormon Central. The church is liberalizing radically fast. It changed some stance on gay adoptions and stuff and gay parishioners that while not condoning it, it's no longer like an automatic excommunication.
Okay.
They're also changing their stance on women because you know why? They're hemorrhaging numbers. And it's hard to get off the Mormon rolls for them to be officially hemorrhaging numbers. It's probably double what they're even saying it is.
It's interesting. You're talking about Salt Lake City. For a while, the Jewish American Holocaust Lit conference was held at Salt Lake City. It was hosted by someone from BYU. And so it was interesting. I got to spend some time in there for a couple of years. And I was really struck by that city and how kind of it was clearly, it felt like it was run by the Mormon church, like subtly sort of. I mean,
no, it still is. The theocratic basis of the stuff here is pretty real from alcohol laws to,
yeah.
At the same token, it's not going to last a whole lot longer. Salt Lake City is only 30% Mormon and declining by the day.
But, well, I was going, it was interesting. Someone who worked for BYU, she told me that, and I'm just taking her word for this, but it sounds right that the Latter-day Saints Church was actually recognizing that there were lots of immigrants, Latinx immigrants coming into Salt Lake City. And as a kind of as a way of kind of stabilizing society, is the way she was sort of framing this, was that they were actually giving money to in neighborhood churches that were not Mormon churches.
Yeah.
To actually, because they know that that's a good way to stabilize a society. It's an efficient way to have a stable, like, well-run society, is to have people plugged into local church parishes. And so they were actually supporting non-Mormon churches.
Yeah, the Catholic, which is crazy from a theological background. Like, that's like traditionally enemy zero, but those are the two groups here. The other thing that where this does matter on values. Because the LDS are not as secularized, they actually have a radically different stance on immigration.
Okay.
Like even the conservative politicians here, like Romney isn't an outlier. Okay. He actually does represent, you know, here popular opinion. The man's a suit, so he's going to reflect the popular opinion here. So, like, Trump is not loved here for two reasons. My own personal theory is, like, the LDS have this real guilty conscience about their stance on most people of color until the 70s.
Okay.
I mean, you know, like, they were, like, BYU was segregated for a long, long time.
Okay.
And there's the whole priesthood could not be given to non-whites until, like, 78 or something. Maybe it's a little earlier than that. But it's still, like, it's almost in my – it's within easy living memory.
Okay.
And the biggest conversion populations for Mormons are, like, the Pacific Islands. It's actually where they first started their non-Anglo Latino groups. They convert a lot in northern Mexico. And that's really their stomping ground. So they can't. And they're also – there's this weird socialistic core to LDS that the other evangelicals don't have because, you know, they used to commonly own property. And stuff. Like, we have a huge down the street, like, charity complex. They hire support refugees who are not Mormons. Like, you see, like, I go down to the Mormon DI, which is, like, the Goodwill run by Mormons.
Yeah.
And half the people there are in hijab. They're actually really good so that cultural aspect is different, but I wonder as things decline, are they going to show the same patterns as the evangelical community does?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I wonder, because what you're describing to me is a very that sounds like that church has not been secularized in the way that kind of general Christianity has been.
But it's beginning to.
It's right. Starting to, right?
Right.
And I wonder if I'm interested in the roots of what causes a religious organization to become secularized. And I really do think it has something to do with institutional structures. And the Mormon Church has a very idiosyncratic tradition, right? As does the Catholic Church, right? And I think the Catholic Church has been slower to secularize too, because it has this other kind of body, this other kind of formal way to govern folks' imaginations and sort of desires through liturgical practice, right? And I think that the Mormon Church is very distinct from American culture, and in a way,
even though
that,
it's like the most American church on earth, but
it is the most. Yeah, you could say it's the most American religion, right? Because it was purely founded, it was created in a very American style, right? But in terms of just sort of demographic distribution, I suppose, and numbers, I suppose, is what I'm talking about. But evangelicals, and I mean, this is a development from the old WASP, right? Mm-hmm. The old concept of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And so the evangelical church, I think, in some ways, picking up in that kind of tradition. And they are almost indistinguishable from the other institutions of American life. And therefore, they have no kind of countercultural way to resist the currents of American life. And I think that maybe that barrier is breaking down for the Mormons. I mean, you would know more than me since you live out there. But
it's breaking down for everybody. But at the same token, like, you put an element in the room that, like, leftists have trouble understanding, I think. It's a liturgical practice tradition that reaffirms some things even beyond belief. When you focus purely on creedal beliefs, how is religion different than any other ideology? And this is also where I argue with like the new atheist understanding, because new atheist understanding of religion comes out of Protestantism, like almost exactly.
Well, they, yeah, in a particularly dumbed down form of it, right? They look at the ultimate fundamentalist and extrapolate that onto every religious person, which is, that's what's annoying to me about that, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are many annoying things about them, but like, but that idea that beliefs are the central thing, that does kind of make flipping your morality to political planks. Because let's also be honest, political identities, and we talk about politics here, it actually isn't politics. These people, the only thing they do that is political is they vote or don't vote. That's the only political act that most of these people take in their life.
These people being...
most everybody, frankly.
Okay, okay, okay.
These people being, like, any secular or religious.
Yeah. Yeah, most people don't actively... are not activists, right? Yeah, most people just...
most activists aren't technically speaking acting politically except in a very, very limited domain.
Yeah.
I mean, like I know when I talk about politics here, I want to separate politics as an action done in a community, which most people really don't actually take part in other than to vote and thus theoretically be represented by.
Yeah.
Which is in America, and actually, let's be frank, everywhere, kind of a questionable proposition, right? Conversely, though, political identity is, like, in American life, but kind of in world life, in many people, the most important thing to people, that's actually where they derive their morality, even if they say they're utilitarians, whatever. Because, like I pointed out earlier, like, if you say you're a utilitarian, why do you believe in human rights? Like, human rights can't be justified on utilitarian grounds, actually. Like, right. If you say you're a utilitarian, why do you have stances on free speech or minority rights or any of that? Like,
okay.
Like, you could argue, well, we're just expanding the circle community and showing individual. Yeah, but like, if, like, I don't think if somehow you knew that and luckily this is not true, but let's say gay marriage did more damage to straight people's psychological well-being, but from a utilitarian argument, even if it's just psychic damage, the majority opinion should dominate. So you're not actually utilitarian.
Yeah. Right. There's another value that's driving your ideas. Right. And that, this actually takes me back to Lionel Trilling. I know that's like probably laughably old school for your audience, right? But like, for whatever reason, because of what I ended up studying in grad school, which was Jewish American fiction, I kind of fell into this kind of affection for folks like the Partisan Review crowd. I mean, that's the name of my show, is a pun on Partisan Review, right? Mm-hmm. And so that whole, like, Lionel Trilling, Irving Howe, that sort of even early commentary magazine was just kind of something I kind of stumbled into. And Trilling actually has remained with me. And at one point in the collection of The Liberal Imagination, which is a book I think a lot of more people should read. I think your listeners would get a lot out of reading at least the introduction of that
book. Even if they hate liberals, they should read it, yes.
No, for sure. I agree. And I think his critique of liberalism is actually one that they would align with, right? I mean, he's coming from this Trotskyist tradition, right? I mean, he's a former kind of like, so all those guys were for like former Trots at City College of New York, and over time kind of melded into liberal society, right? Except maybe Irving Howe. He's probably the one who stayed closest to his roots. But at one point he quotes Goethe, and he says that there's no such thing as liberal ideas. There's just liberal sentiments, right? And so he thinks that this is true, and yet those sentiments only kind of associate, I think is how he says it, with certain ideas. Like, there are certain political stances that the liberal kind of value system will sort of lead itself to, right? But he said the converse is also true. There are sort of ideas that in themselves become sentiments over time. And so his whole like shtick in the liberal imagination was about keeping the liberal imagination fresh so that you're aware of the way this kind of institutional development, which happens slowly over time, just kind of leads everybody along by their nose. And pretty soon they're not even practicing what they preach on some level. And so I really think that Trilling's work is instructive in this way. And I see that certainly happening, like a version of that in evangelicalism. I think there were certain values that mapped onto Republican ideas, but then those Republican ideas became the values in and of themselves without them even being aware of it, right? And I think that's a way in which secularization happened there. But it's the same kind of process, I think, that Trilling is describing back in his criticism of liberal kind of art tastes.
Well, I mean, anyone who watches, I mean, right now liberals like to point it out to against conservatives, but if like conservatives will point it right back against liberals, for example, like the way that the liberal media will get become weirdly jingoistic on war, not off of a principled stance or even a humanitarian interventionist stance, but literally on a fuck you, Donald Trump stance.
Like, it's an identity, right? Right. And so I have identified as this certain thing, and therefore I'm just going to kind of adapt my actual stances to fit that identity in the given historical moment that I'm living it out. And I think that that's been utterly destructive to Christianity. Let me ask you a question. This, I know that I'm usually the one asking you questions. This is weird for you to be asking me questions. Let me ask you a question. About a year, maybe within the last 2 years on lefty Twitter, I'm noticing this refrain, the left is not a church. What are your thoughts on that? I kind of hear that and I snicker a little bit. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, my thoughts on that are complicated. The left shouldn't be a church. And that it shouldn't be a set of prescribed beliefs. It's a set of loosely aligned philosophies engaged in a very specific sets of political tasks. But actually, those political tasks, because the identities we've attached themselves to, are actually more and more multifold over time.
Yeah.
But honestly, the way the left actually works, particularly in the age of social media, but this is not. New to social media. This is what I don't want people to think I'm being that lazy, you know, like those Vox people who always complain about Twitter. Twitter's an accelerated form of this. And that's why it's ridiculous. Like, if you want to find the ridiculous form of anything, you just go on Twitter. But like, political identity has subsumed civic identity in my mind because of alienation. That actually includes religious identity. And okay. It's a substitute for morality. Most people have never had a fully constituted moral theory. And in fact, I kind of agree with the theorist Lester McIntyre that while you can be reasonable about morality, a fully reasoned out total moral theory is impossible because the category is too vague.
Mm-hmm.
But this leads to like people subsuming their politics into their morality and vice versa. The whole personalist political gets flipped on its head.
Yeah.
And the political is personal. And to me, that's destructive because actually it makes it very hard to do political projects. Like, one of the things that you notice about a lot of these things, even when they're doing things like protests, what are they doing? What are they doing really?
I mean, it looks like a worship service to me, right? Right. I mean, it looks like one of those mega church fog machine worship services.
And like at a church, there are moments where subcommittees will do actual things. Like, they will start doing, you'll have someone set up a tenants union, or someone will, you know, do a brakelight clinic, or, you know, the DSA works that way. But I've attended that. As a person who used to attend Baptist church to fit in when I was a kid, because, it looks so similar to me.
Yeah, that's my point.
But to me, that proves that that left is not a valid political project right now, that it has not found its way to be properly a political project.
I'll leave that to you to decide. But what my point is, I think only a church could utter a phrase like the left is not a church. I think that can only be uttered by something that is in fact a church. Because, and honestly, it's the sound the last 20 years, this has been a cliche in kind of evangelical circles about it's about relationship, not religion, right? And this almost sounds like their version of the same phrase. It's the idea that the institution itself is not really what it's about. It's about, you know, your personal, you know, activity, right? And I think when I get what they're saying with the left is not a church, and I mean, they're not wrong in criticizing what's going on, but I think it's a misunderstanding of how they're actually, I mean, though, of the liturgies involved here.
Right.
There are secular liturgies that they are actually partaking of.
Right. Well, I mean, they're a whole, frankly incoherent. More like my favorite is intersectionality standpoint epistemology. I actually am not an anti-intersectional Marxist, despite the way intersectionality is used, though, no one actually knows what it means.
Yeah.
Because it's actually just an analytic for figuring stuff out, like looking at the way standpoint epistemology is assumed, but like it does that Mott and Bailey stuff where the weak form of it is, you know, don't invalidate someone's qualitative experience of this just, you know, out of hand. You know, you must validate their knowledge of their own experience. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's perfectly valid. The strong form of standpoint epistemology is my identity category gives me special insight into reality, particularly the nature of oppression. There's no reason to believe that at all. That is like a metaphysical correlate that does not actually even follow from the weak form. And people go back and forth when you argue them which form they actually mean.
And you see how there's like a direct correlation to a lot of like interactions in Christian culture as well. Like there are versions of, we wouldn't use the term standpoint epistemology, but you know, I have a word from the Lord, right? It is sort of like, and who's going to debate someone, who's going to tell someone that that they misinterpreted their word from the Lord, right? That's something I used to hear in Pentecostal circles all the time.
I mean, the smarter people the smarter apologists do the somewhat intellectually dishonest thing of what presuppositionalism, which is epistemology of like, just assume everything that we're trying to prove is true because you can't really prove anything ipso facto.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to have slightly fallen out of favor because I think it becomes clear that Christians don't actually assume the same things, but even within the same dogmatic sets.
Yeah.
But
another reason I brought that up is that I felt like that came out of a discontent with the real rapid rise of the DSA. I think there were a lot of people thinking the DSA just became sort of like a social club for, you know, whatever, disaffected liberals or something.
Well,
like that,
I mean,
right?
Like,
and radicalized liberals.
You want to talk about the institution? The DSA is set up like a church. And I'll actually talk about this for a second. It's not a political organization. It has planks and platforms. And actually, this its model just like literally you clarified it for me because it's kind of super federated on a U.S. But it's even more than that because while the while the national can tell people rewrite their planks and platforms locally, they generally let them even remove bylaws from the organization at an individual chapter level, and it's based off this confederated government model. But you know what it really feels like? It feels like congregational churches because I've been constantly told by people in the DSA, just because you're in your DSA chapter, your chapter does not have to endorse the actions of the national, nor does the national have to endorse your. So there's actually no real relation between the national and the well, there is, but it's like tangential and very, very minimal. So what can you possibly do? You can't even lobby consistently. You can maybe endorse local area candidates. You can do local charity work. We can call it organizing, but it's actually generally charity work.
Yeah, sounds very familiar to me, right? Yeah.
And honestly, it's based off the primitive accumulation of cadres, which is based off the primitive accumulation of perimeters model. It is, oh my God, a Protestant method of organizing.
You're welcome. No, and honestly, I don't think that's necessarily a terrible thing.
Well, that's like, why it's grown. That is why it's the only left group that's grown.
Yeah, you mentioned before about alienation, right? And so I think there is a real desire amongst people to be with like-minded people and to what they call do life together in banal evangelical circles, right? But I think that that's a not something necessarily to mock, right? I think that that's actually kind of a sign that there is something that the whatever religious world has in common with the secular world. Human beings like to congregate with other human beings, right? And I think that when I'm sort of mocking the idea of the left as a church, I don't mean, haha, you're a church. I'm like, good for you.
Yeah, if the left is now a church, you're no longer just a hashtag.
Sort of, yeah.
I mean, I am mixed on if it's a positive development, but I also don't think it's totally bad. But what I do want to, what I think is it has a social function that kind of deludes itself into thinking it has a political function. But like the Protestant churches in America, you end up being used more than being the user. So the DSA is going to have a hard time navigating, for example, what to do about the Bernie Warren situation. And like, from my perspective, I'm like, you should have known this was coming. Like, there's so many centrists, but the power law means that one of them or two of them is going to rise to the top, but you are going to split your vote with someone who's more closely aligned. And then you can't break with the party because Trump's too scary, but that's going to be true for any Republican forever.
Well, how many can, when was the last time they didn't talk about the Republican candidate being the, you know, whatever secular version of the Antichrist,
right? Yeah, the most important
the most important election of our lifetime.
Every election since that I can remember, including ones I was too young to vote in, were like that.
Yeah.
Now the difference is voter apathy has largely been somewhat, I mean, it's still really high, but it's actually been going down. But yeah, that hasn't translated into much because these identity groups, here's where that Protestant mode of organizing is dangerous for both Christians and for the DSA and stuff. You feel like your group is bigger than it is because you spend so much time around it.
Yeah.
You feel like you are the minor majority because everybody you know and spend time with thinks like you do.
You know, that is one thing about going back to where we started this conversation, living where I live. I honestly, it is a excellent moral exercise in training you how to think generously about other people, right? Because I live around and work with and live near people who I know are wonderful people, right? They're very nice people. They do good things, right? And then I'll hear them say something that's horrifying, right? Politically. and if I didn't know that person, all they would be was that horrifying thing, right? And so it's kind of like this, it's been for 4 years now I've lived here, and it's been kind of a brain-melting experience to try and force myself, I guess my capacity to be hospitable, I suppose, is what I'm talking about here, to accommodate someone's foibles, you know, that are kind of truly scary in some ways, but don't necessarily fully define who they are, right? And I think that's one reason pitfall, I suppose, that the church has always struggled with. Anybody who was not sort of fully affirmable as a person is just sort of verboten, right? And they are sort of this like scapegoat that has to be expelled from the community. And I think that that is a danger, I think, from any kind of community that is echo chambery. All right. And so like living here has been actually a pretty good moral exercise for my virtue capacity.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.